The real flavor of knowledge is most definitely associated in my mind with the vacant lot at the corner of the new neighborhood where I was transplanted at about the age of 10. Here, when the fall days came on and we stood about the bonfire roasting chippies and raw potatoes in the little cans which we carried, there ensued a new type of discussion, which differed from the old discussions I had known in that the origins were always bookish. Someone had just read a book of adventure, or a book of science, and forthwith the whole street became animated by the introduction of a hitherto unknown subject. It might be that one of these boys had just discovered that there was such a thing as the Japanese current, and he would try to explain to us how the Japanese current came into existence and what the purpose of it was. This was the only way we learned things, against the fence, as it were, while roasting chippies and raw potatoes. These bits of knowledge sunk deep, so deep, in fact, that later, confronted with a more accurate knowledge, it was often difficult to dislodge the older knowledge. In this way, it was explained to us one day by an older boy that the Egyptians had known about the circulation of the blood, something which seemed so natural to us that it was hard later to swallow the story of the discovery of the circulation of the blood by an Englishman named Harvey. Nor does it seem strange to me now that in those days most of our conversation was about remote places, such as China, Peru, Egypt, Africa, Iceland, Greenland. We talked about ghosts, about God, about the transmigration of souls, about hell, about astronomy, about strange birds and fish, about the formation of precious stones, about rubber plantations, about methods of torture, about the Aztecs and the Incas, about marine life, about volcanoes and earthquakes, about burial rites and wedding ceremonies in various parts of the earth, about languages, about the origin of the American Indian, about the buffaloes dying out, about strange diseases, about cannibalism, about wizardry, about trips to the moon and what it was like there, about murderers and highwaymen, about the miracles in the Bible, about the manufacture of pottery, about 1,001 subjects, which were never mentioned at home or in school, and which were vital to us because we were starved, and the world was full of wonder and mystery, and it was only when we stood shivering in the vacant lot that we got to talking seriously and felt a need for communication which was at once pleasurable and terrifying. The wonder and the mystery of life, which is throttled in us as we become responsible members of society. Until we were pushed out to work, the world was very small, and we were living on the fringe of it, on the frontier, as it were, of the unknown. A small Greek world, which was nevertheless deep enough to provide all manner of variation, all manner of adventure and speculation. Not so very small, either, since it held in reserve the most boundless potentialities. I have gained nothing by the enlargement of my world. On the contrary, I have lost. I want to become more and more childish and to pass beyond childhood in the opposite direction. I want to go exactly contrary to the normal line of development, pass into a super-infantile realm of being which will be absolutely crazy and chaotic, but not crazy and chaotic as the world about me. I have been an adult and a father and a responsible member of society. I have earned my daily bread. I have adapted myself to a world which never was mine. I want to break through this enlarged world and stand again on the frontier of an unknown world which will throw this pale, unilateral world into shadow. I want to pass beyond the responsibility of fatherhood to the irresponsibility of the anarchic man who cannot be coerced, nor wheedled, nor cajoled, nor bribed, nor traduced. I want to take as my guide Oberon the Night Rider, who under the spread of his black wings eliminates both the beauty and the horror of the past. I want to flee toward a perpetual dawn with a swiftness and relentlessness that leaves no room for remorse, regret, or repentance. I want to outstrip the inventive man who is a curse to the earth in order to stand once again before an impassable deep which not even the strongest wings will enable me to traverse. Even if I must become a wild and natural park, inhabited only by idle dreamers, I must not stop to rest here in the ordered fatuity of responsible adult life. I must do this in remembrance of a life beyond all comparison with the life which was promised me, in remembrance of the life of a child, who was strangled and stifled by the mutual consent of those who had surrendered. Everything which the fathers and the mothers created, I disown. I am going back to a world even smaller than the old Hellenic world, going back to a world which I can always touch with outstretched arms, the world of what I know and see and recognize from moment to moment. Any other world is meaningless to me, and alien and hostile. In retraversing the first bright world which I knew as a child, I wish not to rest there, but to muscle back to a still brighter world from which I must have escaped. What this world is like I do not know, nor am I even sure that I will find it, but it is my world, and nothing else intrigues me. The first glimpse, the first realization of the bright new world came through my meeting Roy Hamilton. I was in my 21st year, probably the worst year of my whole life. I was in such a state of despair that I had decided to leave home. I thought and spoke only of California, where I had planned to go to start a new life. So violently did I dream of this new promised land that later, when I had returned from California, I scarcely remembered the California I had seen, but thought and spoke only of the California which I had known in my dreams. It was just prior to my leave-taking that I met Hamilton. He was a dubious half-brother to my old friend McGregor. They had only recently made each other's acquaintance, as Roy, who had lived most of his life in California, had been under the impression all along that his real father was Mr. Hamilton and not Mr. McGregor. As a matter of fact, it was in order to disentangle the mystery surrounding his parentage that he had come east. Living with the McGregors had apparently brought him no nearer to a solution of the mystery. Indeed, he seemed to be more perplexed than ever, after getting acquainted with the man who he had concluded must be his legitimate father. He was perplexed, as he later admitted to me, because in neither man could he find any resemblance to the man he considered himself to be. It was probably this harassing problem of deciding whom to take for a father which had stimulated the development of his own character. I say this because immediately upon being introduced to him, I felt that I was in the presence of a being such as I had never known before. I had been prepared, through McGregor's description of him, to meet a rather strange individual. Strange in McGregor's mouth, meaning slightly cracked. He was indeed strange, but so sharply sane that I at once felt exalted. For the first time I was talking to a man who got behind the meaning of words and went to the very essence of things. I felt that I was talking to a philosopher, not a philosopher such as I had encountered through books, but a man who philosophized constantly, and who lived this philosophy which he expounded. That is to say, he had no theory at all, except to penetrate to the very essence of things, and in the light of each fresh revelation, to so live his life that there would be a minimum of discord between the truths which were revealed to him and the exemplification of these truths in action. Naturally, his behavior was strange to those about him. It had not, however, been strange to those who knew him out on the coast, where, as he said, he was in his own element. There, apparently, he was regarded as a superior being, and was listened to with the utmost respect, even with awe. I came upon him in the midst of a struggle which I only appreciated many years later. At the time, I couldn't see the importance which he attached to finding his real father. In fact, I used to joke about it, because the role of the father meant little to me, or the role of the mother, for that matter. In Roy Hamilton I saw the ironic struggle of a man who had already emancipated himself, and yet was seeking to establish a solid biological link for which he had absolutely no need. This conflict over the real father had, paradoxically, made him a superfather. He was a teacher and an exemplar. He had only to open his mouth for me to realize that I was listening to a wisdom which was utterly different from anything which I had heretofore associated with that word. It would be easy to dismiss him as a mystic, for a mystic he undoubtedly was, but he was the first mystic I had ever encountered who also knew how to keep his feet on the ground. He was a mystic who knew how to invent practical things, among them a drill such as was badly needed for the oil industry, and from which he later made a fortune. Because of his strange metaphysical talk, however, nobody at the time gave much heed to his very practical invention. it was regarded as another one of his cracked ideas. He was continually talking about himself and his relation to the world about, a quality which created the unfortunate impression that he was simply a blatant egotist. It was even said, which was true enough as far as it went, that he seemed more concerned about the truth of Mr. McGregor's fatherhood than about Mr. McGregor, the father. The implication was that he had no real love for his newfound father, but was simply deriving a strong personal gratification from the truth of the discovery, that he was exploiting his discovery in his usual self-aggrandizing way. It was deeply true, of course, because Mr. McGregor in the flesh was infinitely less than Mr. McGregor as symbol of the lost father. But the McGregors knew nothing about symbols, and would never have understood, even had it been explained to them. They were making a contradictory effort to at once embrace the long-lost son, and at the same time reduce him to an understandable level on which they could seize him not as the long-lost, but simply as the son. Whereas it was obvious to anyone with the least intelligence that this son was not a son at all, but a sort of spiritual father, a sort of Christ, I might say, who was making a most valiant effort to accept as blood and flesh what he had already all too clearly freed himself from. I was surprised and flattered, therefore, that this strange individual whom I looked upon with the warmest admiration should elect to make me his confidant. By comparison, I was very bookish, intellectual, and worldly in a wrong way. But almost immediately I discarded this side of my nature and allowed myself to bask in the warm, immediate light which his profound and natural intuition of things created. To come into his presence gave me the sensation of being undressed, or rather peeled, for it was much more than mere nakedness which he demanded of the person he was talking to. In talking to me, he addressed himself to a me whose existence I had only dimly suspected. The me, for example, which emerged when, suddenly reading a book, I realized that I had been dreaming. Few books had this faculty of putting me into a trance, this trance of utter lucidity in which, unknown to oneself, one makes the deepest resolutions. Roy Hamilton's conversation partook of this quality. It made me more than ever alert, preternaturally alert, without at the same time crumbling the fabric of dream. He was appealing, in other words, to the germ of the self, to the being who would eventually outgrow the naked personality, the synthetic individuality, and leave me truly alone and solitary in order to work out my own proper destiny. Our talk was like a secret language in the midst of which the others went to sleep or faded away like ghosts. For my friend McGregor, it was baffling and irritating. He knew me more intimately than any of the other fellows, but he had never found anything in me to correspond to the character which I now presented him with. He spoke of Roy Hamilton as a bad influence, which again was deeply true, since this unexpected meeting with his half-brother served more than anything else to alienate us. Hamilton opened my eyes and gave me new values, and though later I was to lose the vision which he had bequeathed me, nevertheless I could never again see the world, or my friends, as I had seen them prior to his coming. Hamilton altered me profoundly, as only a rare book, a rare personality, a rare experience can alter one. For the first time in my life, I understood what it was to experience a vital friendship, and yet not to feel enslaved or attached because of the experience. Never, after we parted, did I feel the need of his actual presence. He had given himself completely, and I possessed him without being possessed. It was the first clean, whole experience of friendship, and it was never duplicated by any other friend. Hamilton was friendship itself, rather than a friend. He was the symbol personified, and consequently entirely satisfactory, hence no longer necessary to me. He himself understood this thoroughly. Perhaps it was the fact of having no father that pushed him along the road toward the discovery of the self, which is the final process of identification with the world and the realization consequently of the uselessness of ties. Certainly, as he stood then in the full plenitude of self-realization, no one was necessary to him, least of all the father of flesh and blood whom he vainly sought in Mr. McGregor. It must have been in the nature of a last test for him, his coming east and seeking out his real father, for when he said goodbye, when he renounced Mr. McGregor and Mr. Hamilton also, he was like a man who had purified himself of all dross. Never have I seen a man look so single, so utterly alone and alive and confident of the future as Roy Hamilton looked when he said goodbye. And never have I seen such confusion and misunderstanding as he left behind with the McGregor family. It was as though he had died in their midst, had been resurrected, and was taking leave of them as an utterly new, unknown individual. I can see them now standing in the areaway, their hands sort of foolishly, helplessly empty, weeping they knew not why, unless it was because they were bereft of something they had never possessed. I like to think of it in just this way. They were bewildered and bereft, and vaguely, so very vaguely aware that somehow a great opportunity had been offered them which they had not the strength or the imagination to seize. It was this which the foolish, empty fluttering of the hands indicated to me. It was a gesture more painful to witness than anything I can imagine. It gave me the feeling of the horrible inadequacy of the world when brought face to face with truth. It gave me the feeling of the stupidity of the blood tie and of the love which is not spiritually imbued. I look back rapidly, and I see myself again in California. I am alone, and I am working like a slave in the orange grove at Chula Vista. Am I coming into my own? I think not. I am a very wretched, forlorn, miserable person. I seem to have lost everything. In fact, I am hardly a person. I am more nearly an animal. All day long I am standing or walking behind the two jackasses which are hitched to my sledge. I have no thoughts, no dreams, no desires. I am thoroughly healthy and empty. I am a non-entity. I am so thoroughly alive and healthy that I am like the luscious, deceptive fruit which hangs on the Californian trees. One more ray of sun, and I will be rotten. Pourri avant d'être mouri. Is it really me that is rotting in this bright California sunshine? Is there nothing left of me, of all that I was up to this moment? Let me think a bit. There was Arizona. I remember now that it was already night when I first set foot on Arizona soil, just light enough to catch the last glimpse of a fading mesa. I am walking through the main street of a little town whose name is lost. What am I doing here on this street, in this town? Why, I am in love with Arizona, an Arizona of the mind which I search for in vain with my two good eyes. In the train there was still with me the Arizona which I had brought from New York, even after we had crossed the state line. Was there not a bridge over a canyon which had startled me out of my reverie? A bridge such as I had never seen before, a natural bridge created by cataclysmic eruption thousands of years ago? And over this bridge I had seen a man crossing, a man who looked like an Indian, and he was riding a horse, and there was a long saddlebag hanging beside the stirrup. A natural millinery bridge, which in the dying sun, with air so clear, looked like the youngest, newest bridge imaginable. And over that bridge, so strong, so durable, there passed, praise be to God, just a man and a horse, nothing more. This then was Arizona. And Arizona was not a figment of the imagination, but the imagination itself, dressed as a horse and rider. And this was even more than the imagination itself, because there was no aura of ambiguity, but only sharp and dead isolate, the thing itself which was the dream and the dreamer himself seated on horseback. And as the train stops, I put my foot down, and my foot has put a deep hole in the dream. I am in the Arizona town which is listed in the timetable, and it is only the geographical Arizona which anybody can visit who has the money. I am walking along the main street with a valise, and I see hamburger sandwiches and real estate offices. I feel so terribly deceived that I begin to weep. It is dark now, and I stand at the end of a street where the desert begins, and I weep like a fool. Which me is this weeping? Why, it is the new little me which had begun to germinate back in Brooklyn, and which is now in the midst of a vast desert and doomed to perish. Now, Roy Hamilton, I need you. I need you for one moment, just one little moment, while I am falling apart. I need you because I was not quite ready to do what I have done, and do I not remember your telling me that it was unnecessary to make the trip, but to do it if I must? Why didn't you persuade me not to go? Ah, to persuade was never his way, and to ask advice was never my way. So here I am, bankrupt in the desert, and the bridge which was real is behind me, and what is unreal is before me. And Christ only knows I am so puzzled and bewildered that if I could sink into the earth and disappear, I would do so. I look back rapidly, and I see another man who was left to perish quietly in the bosom of his family. My father. I understand better what happened to him if I go back very, very far and think of such streets as Mauger, Consilier, Humboldt. Humboldt, particularly. These streets belonged to a neighborhood which was not far removed from our neighborhood, but which was different, more glamorous, more mysterious. I had been on Humboldt Street only once as a child, and I no longer remember the reason for that excursion, unless it was to visit some sick relative languishing in a German hospital. But the street itself made a most lasting impression upon me. Why, I have not the faintest idea. It remains in my memory as the most mysterious and the most promising street that ever I have seen. Perhaps when we were making ready to go, my mother had, as usual, promised something spectacular as a reward for accompanying her. I was always being promised things which never materialized. Perhaps then, when I got to Humboldt Street and looked upon this new world with astonishment, perhaps I forgot completely what had been promised me, and the street itself became the reward. I remember that it was very wide, and that there were high stoops, such as I had never seen before, on either side of the street. I remember, too, that in a dressmaker's shop on the first floor of one of these strange houses, there was a bust in the window, with a tape measure slung around the neck, and I know that I was greatly moved by this sight. There was snow on the ground, but the sun was out strong, and I recall vividly how about the bottoms of the ash barrels which had been frozen into the ice, there was then a little pool of water, left by the melting snow. The whole street seemed to be melting in the radiant winter's sun. On the banisters of the high stoops, the mounds of snow which had formed such beautiful white pads were now beginning to slide, to disintegrate, leaving dark patches of the brownstone which was then much in vogue. The little glass signs of the dentists and physicians, tucked away in the corners of the windows, gleamed brilliantly in the noonday sun, and gave me the feeling for the first time that these offices were perhaps not the torture chambers which I knew them to be. I imagined, in my childish way, that here in this neighborhood, in this street particularly, people were more friendly, more expansive, and of course infinitely more wealthy. I must have expanded greatly myself, though only a tot, because for the first time I was looking upon a street which seemed devoid of terror. It was the sort of street, ample, luxurious, gleaming, melting, which later, when I began reading Dostoevsky, I associated with the thaws of St. Petersburg. Even the churches here were of a different style of architecture. There was something semi-oriental about them, something grandiose and warm at the same time, which both frightened me and intrigued me. On this broad, spacious street, I saw that the houses were set well back from the sidewalk, reposing in quiet and dignity, and unmarred by the intercalation of shops and factories and veterinary stables. I saw a street composed of nothing but residences, and I was filled with awe and admiration. All this I remember, and no doubt it influenced me greatly, yet none of this is sufficient to account for the strange power and attraction which the very mention of Humboldt Street still evokes in me. Some years later I went back in the night to look at this street again, and I was even more stirred than when I had looked upon it for the first time. The aspect of the street, of course, had changed, but it was night, and the night is always less cruel than the day. Again I experienced the strange delight of spaciousness, of that luxuriousness which was now somewhat faded, but still redolent, still assertive in a patchy way, as once the brownstone banisters had asserted themselves through the melting snow. Most distinct of all, however, was the almost voluptuous sensation of being on the verge of a discovery. Again I was strongly aware of my mother's presence, of those big puffy sleeves of her fur coat, of the cruel swiftness with which she had whisked me through the street years ago, and of the stubborn tenacity with which I had feasted my eyes on all that was new and strange. On the occasion of this second visit, I seemed to dimly recall another character out of my childhood, the old housekeeper whom they called by the outlandish name of Mrs. Kicking. I could not recall her being taken ill, but I did seem to recall the fact that we were paying her a visit at the hospital where she was dying, and that this hospital must have been near Humboldt Street, which was not dying, but which was radiant in the melting snow of a winter's noon. What then had my mother promised me that I have never since been able to recall? Capable as she was of promising anything, perhaps that day, in a fit of abstraction, she had promised something so preposterous that even I, with all my childish credulity, could not quite swallow it. And yet, if she had promised me the moon, though I knew it was out of the question, I would have struggled to invest her promise with a crumb of faith. I wanted desperately everything that was promised me, and if, upon reflection, I realized that it was clearly impossible, I nevertheless tried in my own way to grope for a means of making these promises realizable. That people could make promises without ever having the least intention of fulfilling them was something unimaginable to me. Even when I was most cruelly deceived, I still believed. I believed that something extraordinary and quite beyond the other person's power had intervened to make the promise null and void. This question of belief, this old promise that was never fulfilled, is what makes me think of my father who was deserted at the moment of his greatest need. Up to the time of his illness, neither my father nor my mother had ever shown any religious inclinations. Though always upholding the church to others, they themselves never set foot in a church from the time that they were married. Those who attended church too regularly, they looked upon as being a bit daffy. The very way they said, "so-and-so is religious," was enough to convey the scorn and contempt, or else the pity which they felt for such individuals. If now and then, because of us children, the pastor called at the house unexpectedly, he was treated as one to whom they were obliged to defer out of ordinary politeness, but whom they had nothing in common with, whom they were a little suspicious of, in fact, as representative of a species midway between a fool and a charlatan. To us, for example, they would say, "a lovely man," but when their cronies came round and the gossip began to fly, then one would hear an entirely different brand of comment, accompanied usually by peals of scornful laughter and sly mimicry. My father fell mortally ill as a result of swearing off too abruptly. All his life he had been a jolly, hale fellow well met. He had put on a rather becoming paunch, his cheeks were well filled out and red as a beet, his manners were easy and indolent, and he seemed destined to live on into a ripe old age, sound and healthy as a nut. But beneath this smooth and jolly exterior, things were not at all well. His affairs were in bad shape, the debts were piling up, and already some of his older friends were beginning to drop him. My mother's attitude was what worried him most. She saw things in a black light, and she took no trouble to conceal it. Now and then she became hysterical, and went at him hammer and tongs, swearing at him in the vilest language, and smashing the dishes and threatening to run away for good. The upshot of it was that he arose one morning determined never to touch another drop. Nobody believed that he meant it seriously. There had been others in the family who swore off, who went on the water wagon, as they used to say, but who quickly tumbled off again. No one in the family, and they had all tried at different times, had ever become a successful teetotaler. But my old man was different. Where or how he got the strength to maintain his resolution, God only knows. It seems incredible to me, because had I been in his boots myself, I would have drunk myself to death. Not the old man, however. This was the first time in his life he had ever shown any resolution about anything. My mother was so astounded that, idiot that she was, she began to make fun of him, to quip him about his strength of will, which had heretofore been so lamentably weak. Still, he stuck to his guns. His drinking pals faded away rather quickly. In short, he soon found himself almost completely isolated. That must have cut him to the quick, for before very many weeks had passed, he became deathly ill, and a consultation was held. He recovered a bit, enough to get out of bed and walk about, but still a very sick man. He was supposed to be suffering from ulcers of the stomach, though nobody was quite sure exactly what ailed him. Everybody understood, however, that he had made a mistake in swearing off so abruptly. It was too late, however, to return to a temperate mode of living. His stomach was so weak that it wouldn't even hold a plate of soup. In a couple of months he was almost a skeleton, and old. He looked like Lazarus raised from the grave. One day my mother took me aside and, with tears in her eyes, begged me to go visit the family doctor and learn the truth about my father's condition. Dr. Rausch had been the family physician for years. He was a typical Dutchman of the old school, rather weary and crotchety now after years of practicing and yet unable to tear himself completely away from his patients. In his stupid Teutonic way, he tried to scare the less serious patients away, tried to argue them into health, as it were. When you walked into his office, he didn't even bother to look up at you, but kept on writing or whatever it might be that he was doing while firing random questions at you, in a perfunctory and insulting manner. He behaved so rudely, so suspiciously, that, ridiculous as it may sound, it almost appeared as though he expected his patients to bring with them not only their ailments, but the proof of their ailments. He made one feel that there was not only something wrong physically, but that there was also something wrong mentally. "You only imagine it," was his favorite phrase, which he flung out with a nasty, leering jibe. Knowing him as I did, and detesting him heartily, I came prepared, that is, with the laboratory analysis of my father's stool. I had also an analysis of his urine in my overcoat pocket, should he demand further proofs. When I was a boy, Dr. Rausch had shown some affection for me, but ever since the day I went to him with a dose of clap, he had lost confidence in me, and always showed a sour puss when I stuck my head through the door. "Like father, like son," was his motto, and I was therefore not at all surprised when, instead of giving me the information which I demanded, he began to lecture me and the old man at the same time for our way of living. "You can't go against nature," he said with a wry, solemn face, not looking at me as he uttered the words, but making some useless notation in his big ledger. I walked quietly up to his desk, stood beside him a moment without making a sound, and then, when he looked up with his usual aggrieved, irritated expression, I said, "I didn't come here for moral instruction. I want to know what's the matter with my father." At this he jumped up, and turning to me with his most severe look, he said, like the stupid, brutal Dutchman that he was, "Your father hasn't a chance of recovering. He'll be dead in less than 6 months." I said, "Thank you. That's all I wanted to know," and I made for the door. Then, as though he felt that he had committed a blunder, he strode after me heavily, and putting his hand on my shoulder, he tried to modify the statement by hemming and hawing, and saying, "I don't mean that it is absolutely certain he will die, etc., which I cut short by opening the door and yelling at him, at the top of my lungs, so that his patients in the anteroom would hear it, "I think you're a goddamned old fart, and I hope you croak. Good night." When I got home, I modified the doctor's report somewhat by saying that my father's condition was very serious, but that if he took good care of himself, he would pull through all right. This seemed to cheer the old man up considerably. Of his own accord, he took to a diet of milk and zwieback, which, whether it was the best thing or not, certainly did him no harm. He remained a sort of semi-invalid for about a year, becoming more and more calm inwardly as time went on, and apparently determined to let nothing disturb his peace of mind, nothing, no matter if everything went to hell. As he grew stronger, he took to making a daily promenade to the cemetery, which was nearby. There he would sit on a bench in the sun and watch the old people potter around the graves. The proximity to the grave, instead of rendering him morbid, seemed to cheer him up. He seemed, if anything, to have become reconciled to the idea of eventual death, a fact which no doubt he had heretofore refused to look in the face. Often he came home with flowers which he had picked in the cemetery, his face beaming with a quiet, serene joy. And seating himself in the armchair, he would recount the conversation which he had had that morning with one of the other valetudinarians who frequented the cemetery. It was obvious after a time that he was really enjoying his sequestration, or rather not just enjoying it, but profiting deeply from the experience in a way that was beyond my mother's intelligence to fathom. He was getting lazy, was the way she expressed it. Sometimes she put it even more extremely, tapping her head with her forefinger as she spoke. but not saying anything overtly, because of my sister, who was, without question, a little wrong in the head. And then one day, through the courtesy of an old widow who used to visit her son's grave every day, and was, as my mother would say, religious, he made the acquaintance of a minister belonging to one of the neighboring churches. This was a momentous event in the old man's life. Suddenly he blossomed forth, and that little sponge of a soul which had almost atrophied through lack of nourishment took on such astounding proportions that he was almost unrecognizable. The man who was responsible for this extraordinary change in the old man was in no way unusual himself. He was a Congregationalist minister, attached to a modest little parish which adjoined our neighborhood. His one virtue was that he kept his religion in the background. The old man quickly fell into a sort of boyish idolatry. He talked of nothing but this minister whom he considered his friend. As he had never looked at the Bible in his life, nor any other book for that matter, it was rather startling, to say the least, to hear him say a little prayer before eating. He performed this little ceremony in a strange way, much the way one takes a tonic, for example. If he recommended me to read a certain chapter of the Bible, he would add very seriously, "It will do you good." It was a new medicine which he had discovered, a sort of quack remedy which was guaranteed to cure all ills, and which one might take even if he had no ills, because in any case it would certainly do no harm. He attended all the services, all the functions which were held at the church, and between times, when out for a stroll, for example, he would stop off at the minister's home and have a little chat with him. If the minister said that the president was a good soul and should be re-elected, the old man would repeat to everyone exactly what the minister had said, and urge them to vote for the president's re-election. Whatever the minister said was right, and just, and nobody could gainsay him. There's no doubt that it was an education for the old man. If the minister had mentioned the pyramids in the course of his sermon, the old man immediately began to inform himself about the pyramids. He would talk about the pyramids as though everyone owed it to himself to become acquainted with the subject. The minister had said that the pyramids were one of the crowning glories of man, ergo, not to know about the pyramids was to be disgracefully ignorant, almost sinful. Fortunately, the minister didn't dwell much on the subject of sin. He was of the modern type of preacher who prevailed on his flock more by arousing their curiosity than by appealing to their conscience. His sermons were more like a night school extension course, and for such as the old man, therefore, highly entertaining and stimulating. Every now and then the male members of the congregation were invited to a little blowout, which was intended to demonstrate that the good pastor was just an ordinary man like themselves, and could, on occasion, enjoy a hearty meal and even a glass of beer. Moreover, it was observed that he even sang, not religious hymns, but jolly little songs of the popular variety. Putting two and two together, one might even infer from such jolly behavior that now and then he enjoyed getting a little piece of tail, always in moderation, to be sure. That was the word that was balsam to the old man's lacerated soul. Moderation. It was like discovering a new sign in the zodiac. And though he was still too ill to attempt a return to even a moderate way of living, nevertheless, it did his soul good. And so, when Uncle Ned, who was continually going on the water wagon and continually falling off it again, came round to the house one evening, the old man delivered him a little lecture on the virtue of moderation. Uncle Ned was, at that moment, on the water wagon, and so, when the old man, moved by his own words, suddenly went to the sideboard to fetch a decanter of wine, everyone was shocked. No one had ever dared invite Uncle Ned to drink when he had sworn off. To venture such a thing constituted a serious breach of loyalty. But the old man did it with such conviction that no one could take offense. And the result was that Uncle Ned took a small glass of wine and went home that evening without stopping off at a saloon to quench his thirst. It was an extraordinary happening, and there was much talk about it for days after. In fact, Uncle Ned began to act a bit queer from that day on. It seems that he went the next day to the wine store and bought a bottle of sherry, which he emptied into the decanter. He placed the decanter on the sideboard, just as he had seen the old man do, and instead of polishing it off in one swoop, he contented himself with a glassful at a time. "Just a thimbleful," as he put it. His behavior was so remarkable that my aunt, who was unable to quite believe her eyes, came one day to the house and held a long conversation with the old man. She asked him, among other things, to invite the minister to the house some evening so that Uncle Ned might have the opportunity of falling under his beneficent influence. The long and short of it was that Ned was soon taken into the fold, and, like the old man, seemed to be thriving under the experience. Things went fine until the day of the picnic. That day, unfortunately, was an unusually warm day, and what with the games, the excitement, the hilarity, Uncle Ned developed an extraordinary thirst. It was not until he was 3 sheets to the wind that someone observed the regularity and the frequency with which he was running to the beer keg. It was then too late. Once in that condition, he was unmanageable. Even the minister could do nothing with him. Ned broke away from the picnic quietly and went on a little rampage which lasted for 3 days and nights. Perhaps it would have lasted longer had he not gotten into a fist fight down at the waterfront, where he was found lying unconscious by the night watchman. He was taken to the hospital with a concussion of the brain from which he never recovered. Returning from the funeral, the old man said, with a dry eye, "Ned didn't know what it was to be temperate. It was his own fault. Anyway, he's better off now." And, as though to prove to the minister that he was not made of the same stuff as Uncle Ned, he became even more assiduous in his churchly duties. He had gotten himself promoted to the position of elder, an office of which he was extremely proud, and by grace of which he was permitted during the Sunday services to aid in taking up the collection. To think of my old man marching up the aisle of a congregational church with a collection box in his hand! To think of him standing reverently before the altar with this collection box while the minister blessed the offering seems to me now something so incredible that I scarcely know what to say of it. I like to think, by contrast, of the man he was when I was just a kid, and I would meet him at the ferry house of a Saturday noon. Surrounding the entrance to the ferry house, there were then 3 saloons, which of a Saturday noon were filled with men who had stopped off for a little bite at the free lunch counter and a schooner of beer. I can see the old man, as he stood in his 30th year, a healthy, genial soul with a smile for everyone and a pleasant quip to pass the time of day, see him with his arm resting on the bar, his straw hat tipped on the back of his head, his left hand raised to down the foaming suds. My eye was then on about a level with his heavy gold chain, which was spread crosswise over his vest. I remember the shepherd plaid suit which he wore in midsummer, and the distinction it gave him among the other men at the bar who were not lucky enough to have been born tailors. I remember the way he would dip his hand into the big glass bowl on the free lunch counter and hand me a few pretzels, saying at the same time that I ought to go and have a look at the scoreboard in the window of the Brooklyn Times nearby. And perhaps, as I ran out of the saloon to see who was winning, a string of cyclists would pass close to the curb, holding to the little strip of asphalt which had been laid down expressly for them. Perhaps the ferry boat was just coming into the dock, and I would stop a moment to watch the men in uniform as they pulled away at the big wooden wheels to which the chains were attached. As the gates were thrown open and the planks laid down, a mob would rush through the shed and make for the saloons which adorned the nearest corners. Those were the days when the old man knew the meaning of moderation, when he drank because he was truly thirsty, and to down a schooner of beer by the ferry house was a man's prerogative. Then it was, as Melville has so well said, "Feed all things with food convenient for them, that is, if the food be procurable. The food of thy soul is light and space, feed it then on light and space. But the food of the body is champagne and oysters, feed it then on champagne and oysters, and so shall it merit a joyful resurrection, if there is any to be." Yes, then it seems to me that the old man's soul had not yet shriveled up, that it was endlessly bounded by light and space, and that his body, heedless of the resurrection, was feeding on all that was convenient and procurable, if not champagne and oysters, at least good lager beer and pretzels. Then his body had not been condemned, nor his way of living, nor his absence of faith. Nor was he yet surrounded by vultures, but only by good comrades, ordinary mortals like himself who looked neither high nor low, but straight ahead, the eye always fixed on the horizon, and content with the sight thereof. And now, as a battered wreck, he has made himself into an elder of the church, and he stands before the altar, gray and bent and withered, while the minister gives his blessing to the measly collection which will go to make a new bowling alley. Perhaps it was necessary for him to experience the birth of the soul, to feed this sponge-like growth with that light and space which the Congregational Church offered. But what a poor substitute for a man who had known the joys of that food which the body craved, and which, without the pangs of conscience, had flooded even his sponge-like soul with a light and space that was ungodly, but radiant and terrestrial. I think again of his seemly little corporation, over which the thick gold chain was strung, and I think that with that death of his paunch there was left to survive only the sponge of a soul, a sort of appendix to his own bodily death. I think of the minister who had swallowed him up as a sort of inhuman sponge-eater, the keeper of a wigwam hung with spiritual scalps. I think of what subsequently ensued as a kind of tragedy in sponges, for though he promised light and space, no sooner had he passed out of my father's life than the whole airy edifice came tumbling down. It all came about in the most ordinary, lifelike way. One evening, after the customary men's meeting, the old man came home with a sorrowful countenance. They had been informed that evening that the minister was taking leave of them. He had been offered a more advantageous position in the township of New Rochelle, and despite his great reluctance to desert his flock, he had decided to accept the offer. He had, of course, accepted it only after much meditation. As a duty, in other words. It would mean a better income, to be sure, but that was nothing compared to the grave responsibilities which he was about to assume. They had need of him in New Rochelle, and he was obeying the voice of his conscience. All this the old man related with the same unctuousness that the minister had given to his words. But it was immediately apparent that the old man was hurt. He couldn't see why New Rochelle could not find another minister. He said it wasn't fair to tempt the minister with a bigger salary. "We need him here," he said, ruefully, with such sadness that I almost felt like weeping. He added that he was going to have a heart-to-heart talk with the minister, that if anybody could persuade him to remain, it was he. In the days that followed, he certainly did his best, no doubt much to the minister's discomfiture. It was distressing to see the blank look on his face when he returned from these conferences. He had the expression of a man who was trying to grasp at a straw to keep from drowning. Naturally, the minister remained adamant. Even when the old man broke down and wept before him, he could not be moved to change his mind. That was the turning point. From that moment on, the old man underwent a radical change. He seemed to grow bitter and querulous. He not only forgot to say grace at the table, but he abstained from going to church. He resumed his old habit of going to the cemetery and basking on a bench. He became morose, then melancholy, and finally there grew into his face an expression of permanent sadness, a sadness encrusted with disillusionment, with despair, with futility. He never again mentioned the man's name, nor the church, nor any of the elders with whom he had once associated. If he happened to pass them in the street, he bade them the time of day without stopping to shake hands. He read the newspapers diligently, from back to front, without comment. Even the ads he read, every one, as though trying to block up a huge hole which was constantly before his eyes. I never heard him laugh again. At the most, he would give us a sort of weary, hopeless smile, a smile which faded instantly and left us with the spectacle of a life extinct. He was dead as a crater, dead beyond all hope of resurrection. And not even had he been given a new stomach, or a tough new intestinal tract, would it have been possible to restore him to life again. He had passed beyond the lure of champagne and oysters, beyond the need of light and space. He was like the dodo which buries its head in the sand and whistles out of its asshole. When he went to sleep in the Morris chair, his lower jaw dropped like a hinge that has become unloosened. He had always been a good snorer, but now he snored louder than ever, like a man who was in truth dead to the world. His snores, in fact, were very much like the death rattle. except that they were punctuated by an intermittent, long, drawn-out whistling of the peanut-stand variety. He seemed, when he snored, to be chopping the whole universe to bits, so that we who succeeded him would have enough kindling wood to last a lifetime. It was the most horrible and fascinating snoring that I have ever listened to. It was stertorous and stentorian, morbid and grotesque. At times it was like an accordion collapsing, at other times like a frog croaking in the swamps. After a prolonged whistle, there sometimes followed a frightful wheeze, as if he were giving up the ghost. Then it would settle back again into a regular rise and fall, a steady, hollow chopping, as though he stood, stripped to the waist, with axe in hand, before the accumulated madness of all the bric-a-brac of this world. What gave these performances a slightly crazy quality was the mummy-like expression of the face in which the big blubber lips alone came to life. They were like the gills of a shark, snoozing on the surface of the still ocean. Blissfully he snored away on the bosom of the deep, never disturbed by a dream or a draught, never fitful, never plagued by an unsatisfied desire. When he closed his eyes and collapsed, the light of the world went out, and he was alone as before birth, a cosmos gnashing itself to bits. He sat there in his Morris chair, as Jonah must have sat in the body of the whale, secure in the last refuge of a black hole, expecting nothing, desiring nothing, not dead, but buried alive, swallowed whole and unscathed, the big blubber lips gently flapping with the flux and reflux of the white breath of emptiness. He was in the land of Nod, searching for Cain and Abel, but encountering no living soul, no word, no sign. He drove with the whale and scraped the icy black bottom. He covered furlongs at top speed, guided only by the fleecy manes of undersea beasts. He was the smoke that curled out of the chimney tops, the heavy layers of cloud that obscured the moon, the thick slime that made the slippery linoleum floor of the ocean depths. He was deader than dead, because alive and empty, beyond all hope of resurrection, in that he had traveled beyond the limits of light and space, and securely nestled himself in the black hole of nothingness. He was more to be envied than pitied, for his sleep was not a lull or an interval, but sleep itself, which is the deep, and hence sleeping, ever deepening, deeper and deeper in sleep, sleeping, the sleep of the deep in deepest sleep, at the nethermost depth full slept, the deepest and sleepest sleep of sleep's sweet sleep. He was asleep. He is asleep. He will be asleep. Sleep. Sleep. Father, sleep, I beg you. For we who are awake are boiling in horror. With the world fluttering away on the last wings of a hollow snore, I see the door opening to admit Grover Watrous. "Christ be with you," he says, dragging his club foot along. He is quite a young man now, and he has found God. There is only one God, and Grover Watrous has found him, and so there is nothing more to say except that everything has to be said over again in Grover Watrous's new God language. This bright new language, which God had invented especially for Grover Watrous, intrigues me enormously. First, because I had always considered Grover to be a hopeless dunce. Second, because I noticed that there are no longer any tobacco stains on his agile fingers. When we were boys, Grover lived next door to us. He would visit me from time to time in order to practice a duet with me. Though he was only 14 or 15, he smoked like a trooper. His mother could do nothing against it, because Grover was a genius, and a genius had to have a little liberty, particularly when he was also unfortunate enough to have been born with a clubfoot. Grover was the kind of genius who thrives on dirt. He not only had nicotine stains on his fingers, but he had filthy black nails which would break under hours of practicing, imposing upon young Grover the ravishing obligation of tearing them off with his teeth. Grover used to spit out broken nails along with the bits of tobacco which got caught in his teeth. It was delightful and stimulating. The cigarettes burned holes into the piano, and, as my mother critically observed, also tarnished the keys. When Grover took leave, the parlor stank like the back room of an undertaker's establishment. It stank of dead cigarettes, sweat, dirty linen, Grover's oaths, and the dry heat left by the dying notes of Weber, Berlioz, Liszt, and company. It stank, too, of Grover's running ear and of his decaying teeth. It stank of his mother's pampering and whimpering. His own home was a stable divinely suited to his genius, but the parlor of our home was like the waiting room of a mortician's office, and Grover was a lout who didn't even know enough to wipe his feet. In the wintertime his nose ran like a sewer, and Grover, being too engrossed in his music to bother wiping his nose, his cold snot was left to trickle down until it reached his lips, where it was sucked in by a very long, white tongue. To the flatulent music of Weber, Berlioz, Liszt, and company, it added a piquant sauce which made those empty devils palatable. Every other word from Grover's lips was an oath, his favorite expression being, "I can't get the fucking thing right." Sometimes he grew so annoyed that he would take his fists and pound the piano like a madman. It was his genius coming out the wrong way. His mother, in fact, used to attach a great deal of importance to these fits of anger. They convinced her that he had something in him. Other people simply said that Grover was impossible. Much was forgiven, however, because of his club foot. Grover was sly enough to exploit this bad foot. Whenever he wanted anything badly, he developed pains in the foot. Only the piano seemed to have no respect for this maimed member. The piano, therefore, was an object to be cursed and kicked and pounded to bits. If he were in good form, on the other hand, Grover would remain at the piano for hours on end. In fact, you couldn't drag him away. On such occasions, his mother would go stand in the grass plot in front of the house and waylay the neighbors in order to squeeze a few words of praise out of them. She would be so carried away by her son's divine playing that she would forget to cook the evening meal. The old man who worked in the sewers usually came home grumpy and famished. Sometimes he would march directly upstairs to the parlor and yank Grover off the piano stool. He had a rather foul vocabulary himself, and when he let loose on his genius of a son, there wasn't much left for Grover to say. In the old man's opinion, Grover was just a lazy son of a bitch who could make a lot of noise. Now and then he threatened to chuck the fucking piano out of the window, and Grover with it. If the mother were rash enough to interfere during these scenes, he would give her a clout and tell her to go piss up the end of a rope. He had his moments of weakness, too, of course, and in such a mood he might ask Grover what the hell he was rattling away at, and if the latter said, for example, "Why, the Sonata Pathétique?" The old buzzard would say, "What the hell does that mean? Why in Christ's name don't they put it down in plain English?" The old man's ignorance was even harder for Grover to bear than his brutality. He was heartily ashamed of his old man, and when the latter was out of sight, he would ridicule him unmercifully. When he got a little older, he used to insinuate that he wouldn't have been born with a club foot if the old man hadn't been such a mean bastard. He said that the old man must have kicked his mother in the belly when she was pregnant. This alleged kick in the belly must have affected Grover in diverse ways, for when he had grown up to be quite a young man, as I was saying, he suddenly took to God with such a passion that there was no blowing your nose before him without first asking God's permission. Grover's conversion followed right upon the old man's deflation, which is why I am reminded of it. Nobody had seen the Watterses for a number of years, and then, right in the midst of a bloody snore, you might say, in pranced Grover, scattering benedictions and calling upon God as his witness as he rolled up his sleeves to deliver us from evil. What I noted first in him was the change in his personal appearance. He had been washed clean in the blood of the Lamb. He was so immaculate, indeed, that there was almost a perfume emanating from him. His speech, too, had been cleaned up. Instead of wild oaths, there were now nothing but blessings and invocations. It was not a conversation which he held with us, but a monologue, in which, if there were any questions, he answered them himself. As he took the chair which was offered him, he said with the nimbleness of a jackrabbit, that God had given his only beloved Son in order that we might enjoy life everlasting. Did we really want this life everlasting? Or were we simply going to wallow in the joys of the flesh and die without knowing salvation? The incongruity of mentioning the joys of the flesh to an aged couple, one of whom was sound asleep and snoring, never struck him, to be sure. He was so alive and jubilant in the first flush of God's merciful grace that he must have forgotten that my sister was Dippy. For, without even inquiring how she had been, he began to harangue her in this newfound spiritual palaver, to which he was entirely impervious, because, as I say, she was minus so many buttons that if he had been talking about chopped spinach, it would have been just as meaningful to her. A phrase like, "the pleasures of the flesh," meant to her something like a beautiful day with a red parasol. I could see by the way she sat on the edge of her chair and bobbed her head that she was only waiting for him to catch his breath in order to inform him that the pastor, her pastor, who was an Episcopalian, had just returned from Europe, and that they were going to have a fair in the basement of the church where she would have a little booth fitted up with doilies from the 5- and 10-cent store. In fact, no sooner had he paused a moment than she let loose, about the canals of Venice, the snow in the Alps, the dog carts in Brussels, the beautiful liverwurst in Munich. She was not only religious, my sister, but she was clean daffy. Grover had just slipped in something about having seen a new heaven and a new earth. "For the first heaven and the first earth were passed away," he said, mumbling the words in a sort of hysterical glissando in order to unburden himself of an oracular message about the new Jerusalem which God had established on earth, and in which he, Grover Watrous, once foul of speech and marred by a twisted foot, had found the peace and the calm of the righteous. "There shall be no more death," he started to shout, when my sister leaned forward and asked him very innocently if he liked to bowl, because the pastor had just installed a beautiful new bowling alley in the basement of the church, and she knew he would be pleased to see Grover, because he was a lovely man, and he was kind to the poor. Grover said that it was a sin to bowl, and that he belonged to no church because the churches were godless. He had even given up playing the piano because God needed him for higher things. "He that overcometh shall inherit all things," he added, "and I will be his God, and he shall be my son." He paused again to blow his nose in a beautiful white handkerchief, whereupon my sister took the occasion to remind him that in the old days he always had a running nose, but that he never wiped it. Grover listened to her very solemnly, and then remarked that he had been cured of many evil ways. At this point the old man woke up, and seeing Grover sitting beside him large as life, he was quite startled, and for a moment or two he was not sure, it seemed, whether Grover was a morbid phenomenon of dream or an hallucination, but the sight of the clean handkerchief brought him quickly to his wits. "Oh, it's you," he exclaimed. "The Watrous boy, what? Well, what in the name of all that's holy are you doing here?" "I came in the name of the Holy of Holies," said Grover, unabashed. "I have been purified by the death of Calvary, and I am here in Christ's sweet name, that ye may be redeemed and walk in light and power and glory." The old man looked dazed. "Well, what's come over you?" he said, giving Grover a feeble, consolatory smile. My mother had just come in from the kitchen and had taken a stand behind Grover's chair. By making a wry grimace with her mouth, she was trying to convey to the old man that Grover was cracked. Even my sister seemed to realize that there was something wrong with him, especially when he had refused to visit the new bowling alley which her lovely pastor had expressly installed for young men such as Grover and his likes. What was the matter with Grover? Nothing, except that his feet were solidly planted on the fifth foundation of the great wall of the holy city of Jerusalem. The fifth foundation made entirely of sardonyx, whence he commanded a view of a pure river of the water of life issuing from the throne of God. And the sight of this river of life was to Grover like the bite of 1,000 fleas in his lower colon. Not until he had run at least 7 times around the earth would he be able to sit quietly on his ass and observe the blindness and the indifference of men with something like equanimity. He was alive and purged, and though to the eyes of the sluggish, skittish spirits who are sane, he was cracked. To me, he seemed infinitely better off this way than before. He was a pest who could do you no harm. If you listened to him long enough, you became somewhat purged yourself, though perhaps unconvinced. Grover's bright new language always caught me in the midriff, and through inordinate laughter cleansed me of the dross accumulated by the sluggish sanity about me. He was alive as Ponce de Leon had hoped to be alive, alive as only a few men have ever been. And being unnaturally alive, he didn't mind in the least if you laughed in his face, nor would he have minded if you had stolen the few possessions which were his. He was alive and empty, which is so close to godhood that it is crazy. With his feet solidly planted on the great wall of the New Jerusalem, Grover knew a joy which is incommensurable. Perhaps if he had not been born with a club foot, he would not have known this incredible joy. Perhaps it was well that his father had kicked the mother in the belly while Grover was still in the womb. Perhaps it was that kick in the belly which had sent Grover soaring, which made him so thoroughly alive and awake that even in his sleep he was delivering God's messages. The harder he labored, the less he was fatigued. He had no more worries, no regrets, no clawing memories. He recognized no duties, no obligations, except to God. And what did God expect of him? Nothing. Nothing except to sing his praises. God only asked of Grover Watrous that he reveal himself alive in the flesh. He only asked of him to be more and more alive. And when fully alive, Grover was a voice, and this voice was a flood which made all dead things into chaos, and this chaos in turn became the mouth of the world, in the very center of which was the verb, to be. In the beginning there was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So God was this strange little infinitive which is all there is. And is it not enough? For Grover it was more than enough. It was everything. Starting from this verb, what difference did it make which road he traveled? To leave the verb was to travel away from the center, to erect a Babel. Perhaps God had deliberately maimed Grover Watrous in order to hold him to the center, to the verb. By an invisible cord, God held Grover Watrous to his stake, which ran through the heart of the world, and Grover became the fat goose which laid a golden egg every day. Why do I write of Grover Watrous? Because I have met thousands of people, and none of them were alive in the way that Grover was. Most of them were more intelligent, many of them were brilliant, some of them were even famous, but none were alive and empty as Grover was. Grover was inexhaustible. He was like a bit of radium, which, even if buried under a mountain, does not lose its power to give off energy. I had seen plenty of so-called energetic people before. Is not America filled with them? But never in the shape of a human being, a reservoir of energy. And what created this inexhaustible reservoir of energy? An illumination. Yes, it happened in the twinkling of an eye, which is the only way that anything important ever does happen. Overnight, all Grover's preconceived values were thrown overboard. Suddenly, just like that, he ceased moving as other people move, he put the brakes on, and he kept the motor running. If once, like other people, he had thought it was necessary to get somewhere, now he knew that somewhere was anywhere, and therefore right here, and so why move? Why not park the car and keep the motor running? Meanwhile, the earth itself is turning, and Grover knew it was turning, and knew that he was turning with it. Is the earth getting anywhere? Grover must undoubtedly have asked himself this question, and must undoubtedly have satisfied himself that it was not getting anywhere. Who, then, had said that we must get somewhere? Grover would inquire of this one and that where they were heading for, and the strange thing was that although they were all heading for their individual destinations, none of them ever stopped to reflect that the one inevitable destination for all alike was the grave. This puzzled Grover, because nobody could convince him that death was not a certainty, whereas anybody could convince anybody else that any other destination was an uncertainty. Convinced of the dead certainty of death, Grover suddenly became tremendously and overwhelmingly alive. For the first time in his life, he began to live. And at the same time, the clubfoot dropped completely out of his consciousness. This is a strange thing, too, when you come to think of it, because the clubfoot, just like death, was another ineluctable fact. Yet the clubfoot dropped out of mind, or, what is more important, all that had been attached to the clubfoot. In the same way, having accepted death, death too dropped out of Grover's mind. Having seized on the single certainty of death, all the uncertainties vanished. The rest of the world was now limping along with club-footed uncertainties, and Grover Watrous alone was free and unimpeded. Grover Watrous was the personification of certainty. He may have been wrong, but he was certain. And what good does it do to be right if one has to limp along with a clubfoot? Only a few men have ever realized the truth of this, and their names have become very great names. Grover Watrous will probably never be known, but he is very great just the same. This is probably the reason why I write about him. Just the fact that I had enough sense to realize that Grover had achieved greatness, even though nobody else will admit it. At the time, I simply thought that Grover was a harmless fanatic. Yes, a little cracked, as my mother insinuated. But every man who has caught the truth of certitude was a little cracked, and it is only these men who have accomplished anything for the world. Other men, other great men, have destroyed a little here and there, but these few whom I speak of, and among whom I include Grover Watrous, were capable of destroying everything in order that the truth might live. Usually these men were born with an impediment, with a clubfoot, so to speak, and by a strange irony it is only the clubfoot which men remember. If a man like Grover becomes depossessed of his clubfoot, the world says that he has become possessed. This is the logic of incertitude, and its fruit is misery. Grover was the only truly joyous being I ever met in my life, and this, therefore, is a little monument which I am erecting in his memory, in the memory of his joyous certitude. It is a pity that he had to use Christ for a crutch, but then what does it matter how one comes by the truth, so long as one pounces upon it and lives by it? An interlude. Confusion is a word we have invented for an order which is not understood. I like to dwell on this period when things were taking shape, because the order, if it were understood, must have been dazzling. In the first place, there was Jaime the bullfrog, and there were also his wife's ovaries, which had been rotting away for a considerable time. Jaime was completely wrapped up in his wife's rotting ovaries. It was the daily topic of conversation. It took precedence now over the cathartic pills and the coated tongue. Jaime dealt in sexual proverbs, as he called them. Everything he said began from or led up to the ovaries. Despite everything, he was still nicking it off with his wife. Prolonged, snake-like copulations in which he would smoke a cigarette or two before uncunting. He would endeavor to explain to me how the pus from the rotting ovaries put her in heat. She had always been a good fuck, but now she was better than ever. Once the ovaries were ripped out, there'd be no telling how she'd take it. She seemed to realize that, too. Ergo, fuck away. Every night, after the dishes were cleared away, they'd strip down in their little bird-like apartment and lie together like a couple of snakes. He tried to describe it to me on a number of occasions, the way she fucked. It was like an oyster inside, an oyster with soft teeth that nibbled away at him. Sometimes it felt as though he were right inside her womb, so soft and fluffy it was, and those soft teeth biting away at his pecker and making him delirious. They used to lie scissors fashion and look up at the ceiling. To keep from coming, he would think about the office, about the little worries which plagued him and kept his bowels tied up in a knot. In between orgasms, he would let his mind dwell on something else, so that when she'd start working on him again, he might imagine he was having a brand new fuck with a brand new cunt. He used to arrange it so that he could look out the window while it was going on. He was getting so adept at it that he could undress a woman on the boulevard there under his window and transport her to the bed. Not only that, but he could actually make her change places with his wife, all without uncunting. Sometimes he'd fuck away like that for a couple of hours and never even bother to shoot off. Why waste it? He would say. Steve Romero, on the other hand, had a hell of a time holding it in. Steve was built like a bull, and he scattered his seed freely. We used to compare notes sometimes, sitting in the chop suey joint around the corner from the office. It was a strange atmosphere. Maybe it was because there was no wine. Maybe it was the funny little black mushrooms they served us. Anyway, it wasn't difficult to get started on the subject. By the time Steve met us, he would already have had his workout, a shower, and a rubdown. He was clean inside and out, almost a perfect specimen of a man. Not very bright, to be sure, but a good egg, a companion. Jaime, on the other hand, was like a toad. He seemed to come to the table direct from the swamps where he had passed a mucky day. Filth rolled off his lips like honey. In fact, you couldn't call it filth in his case, because there wasn't any other ingredient with which you might compare it. It was all one fluid, a slimy, sticky substance made entirely of sex. When he looked at his food, he saw it as potential sperm. If the weather were warm, he would say it was good for the balls. If he took a trolley ride, he knew in advance that the rhythmic movement of the trolley would stimulate his appetite, would give him a slow, personal hard-on, as he put it. Why personal, I never found out, but that was his expression. He liked to go out with us because we were always reasonably sure of picking up something decent. Left to himself, he didn't always fare so well. With us, he got a change of meat. Gentile cunt, as he put it. He liked Gentile cunt. Smelled sweeter, he said. Laughed easier, too. Sometimes in the very midst of things. The one thing he couldn't tolerate was dark meat. It amazed and disgusted him to see me traveling around with Valeska. Once he asked me if she didn't smell kind of extra strong-like. I told him I liked it that way, strong and smelly, with lots of gravy around it. He almost blushed at that. Amazing how delicate he could be about some things. Food, for example. Very finicky about his food. Perhaps a racial trait. Immaculate about his person, too. Couldn't stand the sight of a spot on his clean cuffs. Constantly brushing himself off, constantly taking his pocket mirror out to see if there was any food between his teeth. If he found a crumb, he would hide his face behind the napkin and extract it with his pearl-handled toothpick. The ovaries, of course, he couldn't see, nor could he smell them either, because his wife, too, was an immaculate bitch, douching herself all day long in preparation for the evening nuptials. It was tragic, the importance she gave to her ovaries. Up until the day she was taken to the hospital, she was a regular fucking block. The thought of never being able to fuck again frightened the wits out of her. Jaime, of course, told her it wouldn't make any difference to him one way or the other. Glued to her like a snake, a cigarette in his mouth, the girls passing below on the boulevard, it was hard for him to imagine a woman not being able to fuck anymore. He was sure the operation would be successful. Successful. That's to say that she'd fuck even better than before. He used to tell her that, lying on his back, looking up at the ceiling. "You know I'll always love you," he would say. "Move over just a little bit, will you? There, like that. That's it. What was I saying? Oh, yes. Why, sure, why should you worry about things like that? Of course I'll be true to you. Listen, pull away just a little bit. Yeah, that's it. That's fine." He used to tell us about it in the chop suey joint. Steve would laugh like hell. Steve couldn't do a thing like that. He was too honest, especially with women. That's why he never had any luck. Little Curly, for example, Steve hated Curly, would always get what he wanted. He was a born liar, a born deceiver. Jaime didn't like Curly much either. He said he was dishonest, meaning, of course, dishonest in money matters. About such things, Jaime was scrupulous. What he disliked especially was the way Curly talked about his aunt. It was bad enough, in Jaime's opinion, that he should be screwing the sister of his own mother, but to make her out to be nothing but a piece of stale cheese, that was too much for Jaime. One ought to have a bit of respect for a woman, provided she's not a whore. If she's a whore, that's different. Whores are not women. Whores are whores. That was how Jaime looked at things.